Well, welcome to Palestine Deep Dive, where today we're joined by the award-winning journalist Richard Saunders. Richard has been behind 50-odd films, many of them for Channel 4, of course, and more recently for Al Jazeera. And it's today that we're going to be talking about his latest documentary, which has come courtesy of Al Jazeera's investigative unit. It's going to be released Wednesday. And it's titled October 7th. I've had the opportunity to watch it twice. It's a forensic investigation of the events leading up to October the 7th, during that day and afterwards. It's a very, very powerful documentary. And I was left with the strong feeling that anybody who's expressed any opinion, interest, view over this terrible war that has now lasted for approaching 6 months, anybody that offered an opinion really should be watching this documentary. Nobody comes out of it smelling of roses. You wouldn't expect that. But this is an extraordinarily powerful investigation, which really gets to grips with what happened in the run-up, during and afterwards. And I'd thank you very much indeed, Richard, for joining us. It's quite a venture, because the other thought that did occur to me is that documentaries like this, certainly when I was younger, you would see perhaps in this country programs such as BBC Panorama or ITV's World in Action or TVI, all of these programs, perhaps not necessarily, some of them at least, not necessarily known to some of our viewers. But this powerful investigative strand seems to be rather lacking in a lot of media in this country and elsewhere in the West. And so you've gone to Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera have taken up the cudgel and have produced this documentary. You've produced this documentary. Tell me, why did you think it was an important documentary to make?
I think because the ramifications, the repercussions of October the 7th are so enormous. I mean, the event itself was enormous, but it has been used, it has led to this bombardment, this incursion into the Gaza Strip, which has cost over 31,000 lives as we speak, probably a lot more than 31,000 lives. And a lot, and the repercussions will continue for decades. I mean, I think it's still too early to tell what they really will be, but it really has transformed things in the region. And it was clear that the form the repercussions took was in part dependent on how people understood and interpreted it, what had actually happened on October the 7th. Now, as I was watching the coverage, it seemed to be pretty clear pretty quickly that Hamas had clearly killed a lot of people, Hamas and other people who came through the fence that day, a lot of them civilians. That seemed to me pretty clear. But from the reporting I was hearing, alarm bells began to ring in my head. Two things specifically we explore a great deal in the film: babies and sexual violence. Now, the reason this matters is historically, if you look in situations like this, if you have a slave uprising or an uprising of indigenous people, in the subsequent brutal repression of those people, the allegation is always that they murdered babies and they raped women. It's absolutely without fail. It just happens again and again throughout history. And to see that pattern repeating itself immediately raised alarm bells for me. And I thought it was very important to look into that. And it was quite clear to me that looking at the reporting in the BBC, the New York Times, the Guardian, and so on, they were clearly believing what the Israelis told them.
Richard, this struck me as very powerfully coming through, that essentially Prime Minister Netanyahu, after the events of October 7th, which you detail, I mean, you report on the massacres that took place, you forensically investigate the claims made by all sides and are able to prove how many people were killed on that day and in what circumstances in many cases. But what we also saw in the film is Prime Minister Netanyahu on the phone and subsequently President Biden echoing that same conversation and claiming that he had seen the video material that Benjamin Netanyahu was referring to, and later, of course, the White House admitting that he hadn't. And so there is no question, because unfortunately what we have is a situation whereby some people will say, oh, well, Al Jazeera have set out to prove something. But you would presumably say, well, actually, you've gone and looked at all of the facts, and this is what you found. So what, tell us, if you will, about the lead up to this event in October the 7th, because it didn't happen out of the blue, the actual event. Because you provide in the documentary evidence purporting to show that the Israelis were informed, the Israeli government had been informed that this was going to happen or something similar. And there was a major security failing. So tell us about the events that led up to October the 7th, if you will.
Well, I mean, obviously one could go all the way back to 1948 and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the fact that most people in Gaza are from refugee families, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in practical terms, let's go back to 2018-19 when you have the Great March of Return, when Palestinians in the Gaza Strip demonstrate peacefully for the right to return to their lands for freedom, justice, self-determination, and so on. And the Israelis line up behind sand berms and shoot them. You know, it's appalling what happens. Hundreds are killed. This is a peaceful demonstration. Hundreds of people are killed. And they fail to make any headway at all. The Western media appears entirely indifferent. And we interview Dr. Bassem Naim, who's on the Hamas Council and Governing Council. And it's fascinating. He talks us through the discussions that take place. And there's no reason, I think, to disbelieve him. Their essential analysis was, look, where does this leave us? We've done everything we can. Hamas in the past has done suicide bombings and so on. They've tried peaceful demonstrations. And they've got nowhere. Now, you have this context where the Israelis were reaching out to the Gulf monarchies. The Abraham Accords were being signed. It looked like Israel was going to do a deal with Saudi Arabia. Effectively, the Palestinians were just being erased from history. They in a way were in danger of suffering the same fate as Native Americans or Aboriginal Australians, and just becoming a sort of lost in the mists of history. And it differs, of course, a bit from those situations in that the demographic balance is different. You know, it remains the case that half the people between the river and the sea are Palestinian. Anyway, they felt they just had to do something. They had to do something to break the logjam, to insert the Palestinians back into the narrative. And this is what they did. Now, of course, you can then have opinions about what they did, and what is so striking about that day is clearly the majority of people they killed were civilians. And certainly I think that's something many people, you know, who support the Palestinian cause in the West find very difficult to defend.
Yes, I mean, that there is, and you document all of that. You document the fact that there were Thais who were killed, Buddhists who were killed, that many of the civilians were youngsters at a concert. Of course, you also, and we get onto this, document how some people, some Israelis were probably killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. But I think what people will find interesting, because there has been some reporting of this in the Western media, also in the Israeli media, especially media such as Haaretz, who have been critical of Prime Minister Netanyahu for a long time, actually reporting quite factually, as you do, about Prime Minister Netanyahu's quite open declaration to his own party that it was essential to support Hamas effectively by allowing money from Qatar and elsewhere to go to Hamas. And this is not any great conspiracy theory. This is simply reporting, as you do, that Netanyahu had a view about splitting the Palestinians. Can you explain what you found out about a degree of nefariousness, if you like, from Likud and Netanyahu over their dealings with Hamas, and how it was, perhaps, would you say, because essentially they'd been prepared to support Hamas to weaken the Palestinian Authority, that they, is that one of the reasons why they disbelieved the intelligence that was coming to them?
Well, possibly. I mean, we don't, you know, we don't really have the time to go into this in the film. But certainly the Netanyahu government had been tacitly accepting Hamas for some time and allowing money through to them. They were doing this firstly because it divides the Palestinian cause, secondly because it gives them a good reason not to engage in peace processes. Now, I think that also, you know, there has been some reporting suggesting that meant that the intelligence became tainted, that Netanyahu was not interested in hearing intelligence which said you're playing with fire here. The Hamas is not contained, and you know, this could come back and bite us. You know, I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly, you know, the Israelis had a, it wasn't that they didn't have the information. I mean,
they were given the invasion plan at one stage.
Hamas was training openly within a few hundred meters of the fence and putting their training videos online. So, you know, the Israelis can't pretend they didn't know what was being planned. The problem was the analysis and the interpretation of it. I mean, you know, just because people have a plan to do something doesn't mean they'll do it. Somewhere in the bowels of the Pentagon, there is a plan to invade Canada. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean they're ever going to do it. And I think they just thought Hamas did not have the will, did not have the capacity. They thought their strategy of essentially neutering Hamas and doing what they'd done to Fatah, sort of diverting it into the day-to-day problems of administering a territory, had worked. And that Hamas, you know, Hamas might indulge in this posturing, it might indulge in this morale-boosting training, it might make these blood-curdling noises, but it was never going to do anything. And obviously they got it wrong.
And what we also see in this documentary, and by the way, I don't want to spoil it for people who are going to watch it, and I hope people do, and also share it very, very widely, because this, if this should be another question, do you expect, Richard, that there'll be much interest from other media in what you what Al Jazeera have done? Do you think you'll be getting many reviews? Do you think there'll be a wish to follow up and report on some of these facts that you've uncovered?
I suspect not. I mean, a lot of what we've done, to be fair, particularly on sexual violence, other people have done already. And one of the striking things about this story, and particularly the sexual violence aspect of it, is it provides a case study in the failure of the mainstream media. The New York Times, The Guardian, the BBC have all done pieces on sexual violence, which are based almost entirely on what the Israelis have told them. And it's been left to The Intercept, to Grey Zone, to Mondo Vice, to Yes Magazine, outlets like this to really do groundbreaking work. And I can think of few other examples where it's been so clear cut, where to actually understand what happened, you had to read the alternative media. You couldn't rely on the mainstream media. Whether the Panorama will be inviting me to, I know, I suspect not.
Well, I mean, you know, you in the documentary, you've got the video evidence. You report on the actual Hamas attacks on Israeli security installations, also kibbutzim, civilian targets. You show how, and you have independent security experts. You have, essentially, you have Israelis, Palestinians, Americans, British. I mean, this is as straight as you can get it, as far as I can see. And you have essentially people saying, well, Hamas overcame Israeli security very, very quickly and made a whole series of advances that, you know, many security analysts thought were quite extraordinary. They were up against one of the most highly sophisticated armies apparently in the world, and yet with fairly not particularly sophisticated weaponry, were able to do an enormous amount of damage. And we also see from the documentary that having got as far as they did, some of these Hamas fighters, they then seemed to be lacking any command, and it became ill-disciplined. And there were a lot of civilians who were killed. But you also report on the Israeli reaction, the delayed Israeli reaction, the fact that I think they waited overnight after the first reports. I think I'm right in saying they waited for a night overnight to respond.
Well, what happens is they, on the morning of before dawn on October the 7th, people are, their spotters along the fence were feeding information back and saying, hang on, there's something going on here. There's odd movements. There's something strange going on. And it was taken seriously enough that the head of military intelligence and the head of Shin Bet and so on met up. And they discussed it, they analyzed it. And again, they got it wrong. They said, well, it's probably just another training exercise. Let's come back in the morning and take a look.
It is incredible. And then, of course, what we learned, I mean, there's been a degree of material out there in the media, especially on social media, reports that essentially the reaction of the IDF was disorganized. To say the least, I mean, that you had a situation whereby helicopter pilots were relying on WhatsApp groups for information. And we also learned from your documentary, from the various people that you interview and the evidence that you amass, that essentially the Israeli response then became something which is you refer to as the Hannibal Doctrine. Now, can you explain to us what that actually means and what it meant in effect on that day?
So just to wind back just a bit, and you have to remember the enormous importance of Israel's military and intelligence reputation, the massive deterrence factor it has. You know, here's a nation which consists of 6 million Jewish people living where it is. Since it was created, Israel has depended on this massive deterrence factor, and you can't overstress the degree to which October the 7th was a hammer blow to that. Mm-hmm. The myth of Israeli intelligence omniscience absolutely shattered. The military just collapses in a way that's extraordinary. And I think this is partly what feeds some conspiracy theories in the days afterwards. And I think a number of people thought, oh, hang on, this, I just can't believe this has happened. You know, when they met overnight, one of the extraordinary decisions was not to raise the level of alert. I mean, if they just put the military around the Gaza Strip on alert level one, it would have made a difference. You see the footage, and it's clear a lot of people are killed in their beds. You know, the military is caught completely unprepared. Anyway, they then have to deal with this situation where large numbers of hostages are being taken. Now, in the past, the Israelis, it's fairly well accepted. They've operated a thing called the Hannibal Directive, whereby they essentially say, look, it's better for soldiers to be killed than taken captive. And this is because in the past, Israel's had to do these deals where they exchange one soldier for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, I think, in one case. And they really wanted to avoid that happening again. Now, I think supposedly the Hannibal Directive had been dropped a few years ago. They'd stopped implementing it. The Israeli press has reported that on midday on October the 7th, it's revived. Okay. Mm-hmm. The army has not denied this. It's not confirmed. It's not denied it. And you see it above all in the helicopter gun camera footage, where the Israelis released a lot of this. I think they were very keen to show that, you know, they were responding in some way. We did geolocation, and certainly a lot of the images you're seeing is people passing, traveling towards the west, so they're coming from the settlements towards the Gaza Strip. In other words, the vehicles you're seeing, the groups of people you're seeing, you know, could contain hostages. And certainly when they're hitting vehicles, you're watching it and you're thinking, well, they can't possibly know who's in that vehicle. Now, one of the things we struggled with in the program was the body collection process was quite amateurish. They farm it out to this organization called Zaka, who are volunteers. And, you know, I think they just don't have the capacity to do this, certainly not on this scale. So, you know, we're in the dark about a lot of things. So we have to really sift through the material and the information. We reached a figure of 27 people who we're quite clear were taken hostage, were taken away from their homes by Palestinian gunmen, whether it be Hamas or others, but never made it to the fence. Okay, what with them in between, we simply don't know. But I think it's fair to guess that a number of them may well have been hit by Apache helicopters. There's also an interesting thing. Again, we didn't have room for this in the film. Zaka told me there were 21 bodies that were initially identified as Palestinian and were sent off to the sort of Palestinian body collection. Were then sent back because they were actually Israeli. Now, again, bodies that were found in their homes or in the kibbutzes and so on are probably not going to be mistaken in that way. I think it's a reasonable guess that a number of those bodies were mistaken because they were found with other Palestinians, and possibly in badly disfigured form in sort of open country before the fence. So that's a big source of fire deaths. It's clear as well, the ground troops, certainly in Kibbutz Beri, it's well documented, they opened fire on one house in particular and appear to have killed 12 hostages there. We've identified six other instances where people are clearly killed by ground troops. But again, the figure may be rather higher. You just look at the damage in the kibbutzim after October the 7th. A lot of it is clearly not done by Hamas. It's the houses are not burned, they've been destroyed by heavy weaponry. And it's a reason, and there are bodies under the rubble. There are Israeli bodies under the rubble. And we simply don't know how those people died.
Yes. So in the documentary, we see footage of the kibbutzim houses. We see interviews with the IDF spokespeople, and we see claims about what has happened. You have also in the documentary, you look at the numbers of people who were killed. So insofar as you were able on that day, and you were able to identify how many were in the military, how many were civilians. And also you, as you were just saying, and you've got a fairly good idea from all of the records, how many people may have been killed, obviously a minority, a small minority, but may have been killed by the IDF, obviously in error, but as part of this Hannibal doctrine, if you like. I suppose the really big question, because Prime Minister Netanyahu, in your documentary, is filmed on the telephone speaking to, we think, President Biden, telling him what had happened on that day and making the claims that went all around the world and were picked up here in Britain, they were in the media, they were spoken at by politicians, and these were the claims about the beheaded babies, the children that had been killed. Can you tell us something about the veracity of these claims and what exactly happened on that day?
So the dead babies issue is comparatively simple, because from the list of the dead, we know how many babies died, and it's two. One was a child in Kibbutz Beri, killed when a bullet was fired through a door into a safe room. The other, a Bedouin child, the mother was hit by gunfire at a sort of a road junction, and she and the baby was born by emergency cesarean and died. Those are the two babies that die on October the 7th. Any story about dead babies which is not those two stories is untrue. We know that for a fact. And there were a lot of stories about babies. And we have, the most notorious is the I-24, the channel, the Israeli report of dead babies, many of them beheaded. I mean, that I think, that one, at least some skepticism began to kick in fairly quickly. But people continue to reference babies there, and they still do now. David Lammy, you see him doing it. It wasn't just that I-24 story. The Israeli military were claiming dead babies. Well, one of the particularly interesting things that we uncovered, which actually no one else had spotted before, you have Yossi Landau from Zaka and Colonel Vak of the IDF. They both talk about a specific house in Beri. Yossi Landau talks about two groups of 10 children each, two piles of 10 children each, burned, executed, and so on. Colonel Vak actually talking about the same house, but tells a completely different story, which is eight burned babies that he with his own hands took out. Now, what's interesting is that house is the house which was stormed by the Israeli police and army. So we know exactly who was in it. We know they were killed by the Israeli police and army, or almost certainly killed by the Israeli police and army. And also we know there were no babies there. And there were two children, 12-year-old twins, but no other children. So the two piles of 10 children each. But that's a thing that others haven't spotted, that those two stories apply to the same house.
And Richard, to what degree in Israel itself is this being reported? I mean, we understand that there's media such as Haaretz and others who raised up sceptical points at the time. But I mean, because it's very easy for people to just turn around and say, oh, look, it's Al Jazeera. They would say this, wouldn't they? But to what degree in Israel is this being reported? And to what degree, I mean, perhaps this, you can't really answer this, but to what degree is this reality of some of what happened fueling Israeli public opinion, you know, especially those who have perhaps got family who are still being held hostage by Hamas, who really do doubt what they hear from their own government and prime minister?
How much the stuff about babies and sexual violence is being reported, I think not a great deal. Haaretz has done some good stuff, but of course, within the Israeli context, Haaretz is on the far, far left and has a pretty small readership. Where the Israeli media has done a good job is these friendly fire deaths, particularly the incident at Kibbutz Be'eri. If you watch our film, actually, a lot of it, we take quite a lot of stuff from Israel's Channel 12, which has done some good stuff on this. So, you know, actually, on that issue, friendly fire deaths, the Israeli media has certainly been better than the Western media.
And I mean, we've just heard, of course, there were the Israeli raid on Al Shifa Hospital. Hostilities have begun again in the Gaza Strip, around the Al Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. And now, one of your colleagues, Al Jazeera colleagues, has been arrested and taken away. And I suppose what we've seen throughout is that the messengers, whether they be journalists or others, are often seen as being rather difficult people to deal with and people you want to get out of the way. But tell me, when you were making this documentary, did you find it quite easy to speak to figures from the IDF, from within the Israeli security establishment, and also from Hamas and Fatah and others? How easy did you find it to speak to the people that you need to speak to?
Well, Hamas put up Dr. Naim, so that Hamas gave us an interviewee. On the Israeli side, I'm very grateful to Professor Freilich, who is, you know, obviously a part of the sort of Israeli establishment, for giving us an interview. And Yossi Landau from Zaka, who gave us an interview, which rather surprisingly gave us an interview. So, you know, I'm grateful for those people for doing that. On the whole, the Israeli government and military did not want to speak to us. They're very clear that it's clear they didn't. I would very much like to speak to people on the ground, who Hamas fighters and others who went through the fence that day. It's pretty much impossible in the current circumstances. On the whole, with Israeli survivors, we weren't going to pointlessly harass families. On the whole, people aren't going to want to speak to Al Jazeera. But also, to be honest, their testimonies were so widely available. And we did a very careful trawl of everything survivors had said, and sort of cross-referencing, and, you know, we a huge database of survivor accounts. For ourselves, what we actually did was, because we have an office in Bangkok, we interviewed a Thai survivor, which was a very interesting perspective.
And I mean, you talk about the sexual violence of that day, the claims that have been made, the evidence of it. Can you give us, I mean, the documentary does, of course, but for the benefit of people watching, can you give us an idea of what you discovered happened on that day? And was mass sexual violence used by Hamas as a weapon? This is certainly very much the narrative that came out in much of the media at the time.
The basic answer is no. There simply is not the evidence, or anything approaching sufficient evidence, to suggest that sexual violence was systematic and widespread and deliberate and instrumentalized and weaponized. You would expect far more evidence than that. Now, whether isolated incidents of rape occurred, we just don't know. And it's possible, you know, the rape very commonly does occur in situations of war, and you certainly can't rule that out.
Yes, I mean, we have seen video, I think, of, I mean, I've certainly seen video of young women being dragged and treated appallingly and thrown into the back of trucks and things like that. But we, of course, beyond that, we have to hear the reports of others. But essentially what you're saying is that there is actually no established evidence that the Israelis have acted. Have the Israelis provided any evidence, firm evidence?
None at all. Well, essentially, if you actually look at the reporting in things like the BBC, the Guardian, and the New York Times, it's quite clear that they're getting all their reporting from Israeli officials, IDF officials, and first responders. Now, you know, the big significance of the baby story is that we know all those stories are untrue, and they were all coming from Israeli officials, the IDF, and first responders. And if those sources have proved extremely unreliable in that story, then common sense says they're going to be unreliable in other stories. So you look for other evidence, and the visual evidence just isn't there. You know, yes, there is footage of young Israeli women being taken hostage. Yes, but that's not evidence of rape, you know. I think people can rather fill in they rather fill in the gaps in their imagination, but that's nothing like that doesn't even approach evidence. The 7 hours of footage I watched from the day, there's no sexual violence occurs. There's dreadful things happen in it, but there isn't any sexual violence in that footage. Post mortem, the films and the photographs taken after the event. No, again, I mean, yeah, yes, you see dead people with lots of blood on them, but you know, that's not evidence of rape. I mean, if we take one case study, one image that I took very, very seriously, there was a young woman. She was killed, shot 9 miles north of the music festival site as she was escaping very early in the morning, you know, about 7 a.m. And this was the centerpiece of the New York Times story, their big Screams Without Words story. And about a third of the article consisted of this. And almost immediately it had come out, the woman's family or her sister spoke out, said, hang on, this isn't true. And when we spoke to the New York Times about this, they didn't tell us this was a story about sexual violence. We know she wasn't raped because she was texting us almost up to the moment of her death. Her husband, who was with her, spoke to his brother for 44 minutes immediately afterwards, and didn't mention a rape. You know, we know she wasn't raped. So that, in a way, was the most powerful image that was the centerpiece of one of the biggest investigations the New York Times into this, and it collapsed almost immediately. So there just isn't. For example, the Israelis will talk a lot about how you have bodies of young women tied to posts, tied to trees, with the lower part of their clothing removed. But again, not a single image to support this. Now, Zaka, who were responsible for collecting bodies, will say, well, we weren't told to take photos. It's not what we're trained in, and so on, which might be true. But there's not a single image to support this. And there are thousands of images of the immediate aftermath. And another example, you will see first responders, people who worked in the morgues, who will talk again and again about the sexual mutilation of corpses. Now, the somewhat dubious UN report, which came out about 3 weeks ago, you know, garnered the headlines that I think the Israelis wanted. If you actually read it, there's some serious professional work that has gone on there. And one of the things they say is we could see no evidence for a pattern of sexual mutilation of corpses at all. So basically, there we can go on to the issue of witnesses as well, of whom there are remarkably few, and there's certainly no victims, possibly because they're dead. I mean, of course. And this is the point we make in the film. Yes, you know, perhaps there were isolated instances of rape, but if it was systematic and widespread, you would have some evidence. You'd have some evidence.
There is the old adage about the fog of war and truth being the first casualty. The propensity after something as shocking as the October 7 attacks being broadcast around the world and people reaching, simply believing what they're told without doing due diligence. And of course, you know, it could be argued that happened more recently over the Israeli claims about UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and their claims that a number of UNRWA staffers were also acting for Hamas. And of course, it is being investigated. The United Nations has set up an investigation into all of that. I believe Israel's been invited to participate, but isn't. But essentially, those claims were believed in the same way in Netanyahu's claims were immediately believed too, and the consequences were incredibly severe, possibly arguably compounded by the fact that the Commissioner General of UNRWA fired those accused without any due diligence beforehand. They could have suspended them, you know, pending investigation. But I think I mean, I don't know if you would agree that essentially, you know, your documentary shows that this immediate belief in the in whatever people are being told, and the sheer horror of what people are being told, almost allowed some people who would, in other circumstances, say international law has got to run, international law has got to be followed in conflict. It all fell apart. And you could argue, I don't know, but I mean, this is not your point in the documentary to make these arguments, but essentially that as a result of those claims, especially about the murdered babies, and that the green light was given to the most extreme response imaginable in Gaza, and which we've seen.
No, absolutely. And this is a very important point in the film. When we're saying babies weren't butchered and murdered, women weren't raped on a widespread systematic scale, well, it's not nitpicking, it's not pedantry. We're not saying all people died in this way, not in that way. The reason, the justification, when the Israelis and their allies are justifying the continued assault on the Gaza Strip and the enormous casualty figures, they always reference babies and rape. Every time it's babies and rape. And that's why it's so important, because that is the great justificatory element.
I mean, do you think that what could come out of this possibly is a kind of a truth and reconciliation commission, if you like, or an investigation that really gets to the bottom so that lessons are learned, if they can be learned? I mean, I'm not trivializing this when I say it, because you're right at the very beginning of our interview, when you talked about the claims made on the day, they are so reminiscent of claims that are made time after time in brutal conflicts. And, you know, in the First World War, claims were made about German soldiers killing babies on the pikes on their helmets. So it's not a new thing, as you were saying, but do you think this documentary can be taken, along with all the other evidence that has been made available and can yet be made available, to really provide a proper record of what happened today, so that people are prepared for when it happens again? Because it sadly probably will.
Well, all we can do is put the, you know, it's a very important job journalists have, is we put the proper information out there so that people are making informed decisions. Now, whether they want to make informed, you know, what decisions they want to make and so on the basis of that is up to them. And of course, you know, we struggle to actually get impact and reach. But, you know, it's terribly important to put an accurate assessment of things out there. And I hope it will be useful to people. As for what it leads to politically, I think the chances of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission are pretty much zero. Mm. You know, the essence of this situation remains the same as it's always done. The Israelis won't compromise because they don't need compromise, because they have the pretty much unquestioning support of the West. And, you know, that's all it boils down to.
However, I think that, you know, as from many of your previous documentaries, even if much of the mainstream, and particularly the Western media, may choose not really to focus on this work and to possibly ignore it, not review it, I think many, many people out there around the world are going to be watching it, and they're going to be reaching their own conclusions from it. And, you know, right from the outset, we were saying that anybody who has been watching these events unfold over the past 5 months and has voiced an opinion, whatever it might have been, who's got a passion about this in one way or another, should watch your documentary. And perhaps we could just finish, Richard, just let us know, if you will, when it's going to be available and how people can watch it.
Okay, so YouTube, just type in Al Jazeera October 7th. You'll find it. It's age restricted. It's not really an appropriate film for people who are under 18. And on the Al Jazeera website, you'll be able to find it as well. And yes, please do watch it and share it as well, because with the stuff Al Jazeera does, we often do find we're subject to this sort of omerta by the British press in particular. So I always urge people to share it, because it's pretty much the only way these things spread. But it's quite an effective way in the social media age. You can reach millions of people in that way.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you for all that you do, and thank you to the Al Jazeera investigative team, and good luck with the film and the documentary. Thanks for joining us. Until next time.
Thank you.